I suppose you could be right. You are, once in a while. Occasionally. Obi-Wan chuckled and clapped him on the shoulder. Farewell, old friend. Master, wait. Anakin turned to face him fully. He couldn't just stand here and let him walk away. Not now. He had to say something. He had a sinking feeling he might not get another chance. Master, he said hesitantly, I know I've disappointed you in these past few days. I have been arrogant. I have not been very appreciative of your training, and what's worse, of your friendship. I offer no excuse, Master. My frustration with the Council, I know that none of it is your fault, and I apologize. For all of it. Your friendship means everything to me. Obi-Wan gripped Anakin's mechanical hand, and with his other, he squeezed Anakin's arm above the joining of flesh and metal. You are wise and strong, Anakin. You are a credit to the Jedi Order, and you have far surpassed my humble efforts at instruction. Anakin felt his own smile turn melancholy. Just the other day, you were saying that my power is no credit to me. I'm not speaking of your power, Anakin, but of your heart. The greatness in you is a greatness of spirit. Courage and generosity, compassion and commitment, these are your virtues. Obi-Wan said gently, You have done great things, and I am very proud of you. Anakin found he had nothing to say. Well, Obi-Wan looked down, chuckling, releasing Anakin's hand and arm. I believe I hear General Grievous calling my name. Goodbye, old friend. May the Force be with you. All Anakin could offer in return was a reflexive echo. May the Force be with you. He stood, still and silent, and watched Obi-Wan walk away. Then he turned and slowly, head hanging, moved toward his speeder. The Chancellor was waiting. Chapter 14. Free Fall in the Dark. A chill wind scoured the Chancellor's private landing deck at the Senate office building. Anakin stood wrapped in his cloak, chin to his chest, staring down at the deck below his feet. He didn't feel the chill or the wind. He didn't hear the whine of the Chancellor's private shuttle angling in for a landing, or smell the swirls of brown smog coiling along the wind. What he saw were the faces of senators who had stood on this deck to cheer for him. What he heard were exclamations of joy and congratulations when he returned their Supreme Chancellor to them unharmed. What he felt was a memory of hot pride at being the focus of so many eager holonet crews, anxious to get even the slightest glimpse of the man who had conquered Count Dooku. How many days ago had that been? He couldn't remember. Not many. When you don't sleep, days smear together into a haze of fatigue so deep it becomes a physical pain. The Force could keep him upright, keep him moving, keep him thinking, but it could not give him rest. Not that he wanted rest. Rest might bring sleep. What sleep might bring, he could not bear to know. He remembered Obi-Wan telling him about some poet he'd once read. He couldn't remember the name or the exact quote, but it was something about how there is no greater misery than to remember, with bitter regret, a day when you were happy. How had everything gone so fast from so right to so wrong? He couldn't even imagine. Greasy dust swirled under the shuttle's repulsors as it settled to the deck. The hatch cycled open, and four of Palpatine's personal guards glided out, long robes catching the breeze in silken, blood-colored ripples. They split into two pairs to flank the doors as the Chancellor emerged beside the tall, bulky form of Mas Amida, the Speaker of the Senate. The Chagrian's horns tilted over Palpatine as they walked together, seemingly deep in conversation. Anakin moved forward to meet them. "Chancellor," he said, bowing a greeting. "Lord Speaker?" Mas Amida looked at Anakin with a curl to his blue lips that on a human would have signaled disgust. It was a Chagrian smile.
"Greetings, Your Grace. I trust the day finds you well."
Anakin's eyes felt as if they'd been dusted with sand. Very well, Lord Speaker. Thank you for asking. Amidah turned back to Palpatine, and Anakin's polite smile faded to a twist of contempt. Maybe he was just overtired, but somehow, looking at the curlings of the Chagorian's naked head tentacles as they twisted across his chest, he found himself hoping that Obi-Wan hadn't been lying to him about Sidious. He rather hoped that Mas Amidah might be a secret Sith, because something about the Speaker of the Senate was so revolting that Anakin could easily imagine just slicing his head in half. It gradually dawned on Anakin that Palpatine was giving Mas Amidah the brush-off and was sending the red robes with him. Good. He wasn't in the mood to play games. By themselves, they could talk straight with each other. A little straight talk might be just what he needed. A little straight talk might burn through the fog of half-truths and subtle confusions that the Jedi Council had poured into his head. "So, Anakin," Palpatine said as the others moved away, "did you see your friend off?" Anakin nodded. "If I didn't hate Grievous so much, I'd almost feel sorry for him." "Oh?" Palpatine appeared mildly interested. "Are Jedi allowed to hate?" "Figure of speech," Anakin said, waving this off. "It doesn't matter how I feel about Grievous. Obi-Wan will soon have his head." "Provided, of course," Palpatine murmured as he took Anakin's arm to guide him toward the entryway, "that the Council didn't make a mistake. I still believe Master Kenobi is not the Jedi for this job." Anakin shrugged irritably. Why did everyone keep bringing up things he didn't want to talk about? The Council was very sure in its decision. "Certainty is a fine thing," the Chancellor allowed, "though it too often happens that those who are the most entirely certain are also the most entirely wrong. What will the Council do if Kenobi proves unable to apprehend Grievous without your help?" "I'm sure I cannot say, sir. I imagine they will deal with that if and when it happens. The Jedi teach that anticipation is distraction." "I am no philosopher, Anakin. In my work, anticipation is often my sole hope of success. I must anticipate the actions of my adversaries, and even those of my allies. Even," he opened a hand toward Anakin, smiling, "my friends. It is the only way I can be prepared to take advantage of opportunity and, conversely, to avoid disaster." "But if a disaster comes about by the will of the Force..." "I'm afraid I don't believe in the will of the Force," Palpatine said, his smile turning apologetic. "I believe it is our will that matters. I believe that everything good in our civilization has come about not by the blind action of some mystical field of energy, but by the focused will of people, lawmakers and warriors, inventors and engineers, struggling with every breath of their bodies to shape galactic culture, to improve the lives of all." They stood now before the vaulted door to Palpatine's office. "Please come in, Anakin. Much as I enjoy a philosophical chat, that was not the reason I asked you to meet me. We have business to discuss, and I fear it may be very serious business indeed." Anakin followed him through the outer chambers to Palpatine's intimate private office. He took up a respectful standing position opposite Palpatine's desk, but the Chancellor waved him to a chair. "Please, Anakin, make yourself comfortable. Some of this may be difficult for you to hear." "Everything is, these days," Anakin muttered as he took a seat. Palpatine didn't seem to hear. "It concerns Master Kenobi. My friends among the senators have picked up some disturbing rumors about him. Many in the Senate believe that Kenobi is not fit for this assignment." Anakin frowned. "Are you serious?" "I'm most serious, I'm afraid. It is a complicated situation, Anakin. It seems there are some in the Senate who now regret having granted me emergency powers." "There have been dissenters and naysayers since before Geonosis, sir. Why should it be cause for concern now? And how does it affect Obi-Wan?" "I'm getting to that. Palpatine took a deep breath and swung his chair around so that he could gaze through his window of armored transparasteel onto the cityscape beyond. The difference is that now some of these senators, actually a large number of them, seem to have given up on democracy. Unable to achieve their ends in the Senate, they are organizing into a cabal, preparing to remove me by other means. You mean treason? Anakin had enough Jedi discipline to force away his memory of using that word with Obi-Wan. I'm afraid so. The rumor is that the ringleaders of this group may have fallen victim to the persuasive powers of the Jedi Council and are on their way to becoming accomplices in the Council's plot against the Republic. Sir, Anakin shook his head. This just seems ridiculous. And it may be entirely false. Remember that these are only rumors, entirely unconfirmed. Senate gossip is rarely accurate. But if this is true, we must be prepared, Anakin. I still have friends enough in the Senate to catch the scent of whatever this disloyal cabal is cooking up. And I have a very good idea of who the leaders are. In fact, my final meeting this afternoon is with a delegation representing the cabal. I would like you to be present for that as well.
Me? He said, and then thought, couldn't everyone leave me alone for a day, for even a few hours?
What for? He asked. Your Jedi senses, Anakin. Your ability to read evil intent. I have no doubt these senators will put some virtuous facade on their plotting. With your help, we will pierce that veil and discover the truth.
Anakin sighed, rubbing his stinging eyes. How could he let Palpatine down?
I'm willing to try, sir.
We won't try, Anakin. We will do. After all, they are only senators. Most of them couldn't hide what they're thinking from a brain-damaged blind worm, let alone the most powerful Jedi in the galaxy.
He leaned back in his chair and steepled his fingers pensively.
The Jedi Council, however, is another matter entirely. A secret society of anti-democratic beings who wield tremendous power, individually as well as collectively. How am I to trace the labyrinth of their plots? That's why I put you on the Council. If these rumors are true, you may be democracy's last hope.
Anakin let his chin sink once more to his chest, and his eyelids scraped shut. It seemed like he was always somebody's last hope. Why did everyone always have to make their problems into his problems? Why couldn't people just let him be? How was he supposed to deal with all this when Padme could die? He said slowly, eyes still closed.
You still haven't told me what this has to do with Obi-Wan.
Ah, that. Well, that is the difficult part. The disturbing part. It seems that Master Kenobi has been in contact with a certain senator who is known to be among the leaders of this cabal. Apparently, very close contact. The rumor is that he was seen leaving the senator's residence this very morning at an unseemly hour.
Who?
Anakin opened his eyes and sat forward. Who is the senator? Let's go question him.
I'm sorry, Anakin, but the senator in question is, in fact, a her. A woman you know quite well, in fact.
You?
He wasn't hearing this. He couldn't be.
You mean?
Anakin choked on her name. Palpatine gave him a look of melancholy sympathy.
I'm afraid so.
Anakin coughed his voice back to life. That's impossible. I would know. She couldn't.
Sometimes the closest, Palpatine said sadly, are those who cannot see.
Anakin sat back, stunned. He felt like he'd been punched in the chest by a Gamorrean, by a Rancor. His ears rang, and the room whirled around him.
I would know, he repeated numbly. I would know.
Don't take it too hard, Palpatine said. It may be only idle gossip.
All this may be only a figment of my overheated imagination. After all these years of war, I find myself inspecting every shadow that might hide an enemy. That is what I need from you, Anakin. I need you to find the truth, to set my mind at rest.
A distant smolder kindled under Anakin's breastbone, so faint as to be barely there at all. But even a hint of that fire gave Anakin the strength to throw himself to his feet.
I can do that, he said. The flame grew stronger now, hotter. The numb fatigue that had dragged at his limbs began to burn away.
Good, Anakin. I knew I could count on you.
Always, sir. Always.
He turned to go. He would go to her. He would see her. He would get the truth. He would do it now, right now, in the middle of the day. It didn't matter who might see him. This was business.
I know who my friends are, he said, and left.
He moved through Padme's apartment like a shadow, like a ghost at a banquet. He touched nothing. He looked at everything. He felt as if he'd never seen it before. How could she do this to him?
Sometimes the closest are those who cannot see.
How could she? How could he? In the Force, the whole apartment stank of Obi-Wan. His finger traced the curving back of her couch. Here, Obi-Wan had sat here.
Anakin rounded the couch and settled into that same spot. His hand fell naturally to the seat beside him.
And there, he felt an echo of Padme.
The dragon whispered, "That's a little close for casual conversation."
This was a different kind of fear, even colder, even uglier. Fear that Palpatine might be right.
The apartment's air still hummed with discord and worry, and there was a smell of oxidized spices and boiled seaweed.
Hoi broth, that was it. Someone in the past few hours had been drinking hoi broth in this room.
Padme hated hoi broth, and Obi-Wan was allergic to it.
Once, on a diplomatic mission to Ando, his violent reaction to a ceremonial toast had nearly triggered an inter-system incident.
So Padme had been entertaining other visitors, too. From a pocket on his equipment belt, he pulled a flimsy of Palpatine's list of suspect senators. He scanned down the list, looking for names of senators he knew well enough that he might recognize the Force echoes of their presence here. Many he'd never heard of. There were thousands of senators after all. But those he knew by reputation were the cream of the Senate. People like Tarrant'Neil, Fang Zar, Bail Organa, Garm Bel Iblis. He began to think Palpatine was just imagining things after all. These beings were known to be incorruptible. He frowned down at the flimsy. It was possible. A senator might carefully construct a reputation appearing to all the galaxy as honest and upright and honorable, all the while holding the rotten truth of himself so absolutely secret that no one would sense his evil until he had so much power that it was too late to stop him. It was possible.
But so many. Could they all have accomplished that?
Could Padme? Suspicion leaked back into his mind and gathered itself into so thick a cloud that he didn't sense her approach until she was already in the room.
Anakin, what are you doing here? It's still the middle of the afternoon.
He looked up to find her standing in the archway in full senatorial regalia. Heavy folds of burgundy robes and a coif like a starfighter's hyperdrive ring. Instead of a smile, instead of sunlight in her eyes, instead of the bell-clear joy with which she had always greeted him, her face was nearly expressionless, attentively blank. Anakin called it her politician look, and he hated it.
"Waiting for you," he replied, a little unsteadily.
"What are you doing here in the middle of the afternoon?"
"I have a very important meeting in 2 hours," she said stiffly. "I left a document reader here this morning."
"This meeting, Is it with the Chancellor? Anakin's voice came out low and harsh. Is it his last meeting of the afternoon?
Yes. Yes, it is.
She frowned, blinking.
Anakin, what?
I have to be there, too. He crumpled the flimsy and stuffed it back into his equipment belt. I'm starting to look forward to it.
Anakin, what is it?
She came toward him, one hand reaching for him.
What's wrong?
He lurched to his feet. Obi-Wan's been here, hasn't he?
He came by this morning.
She stopped. Her hand slowly lowered back to her side.
Why?
What did you talk about?
Anakin, why are you acting like this?
One long stride brought him to her. He towered over her. For one stretching second, she looked very small, very insignificant, very much like some kind of bug that he could crush beneath his heel and just keep on walking. What did you talk about? She gazed steadily up at him, and on her face was only concern, shaded with growing hurt.
We talked about you.
What about me? He's worried about you, Anakin. He says you're under a lot of stress. And he's not?
The way you've been acting since you got back.
I'm not the one doing the acting. I'm not the one doing the pretending. I'm not the one sneaking in here in the morning.
No, she said with a smile. She reached up to lay the palm of her hand along the line of his jaw. That's usually when you're sneaking out.
Her touch unclenched his heart. He half fell into a chair and pressed the edge of his flesh hand against his eyes. When he could overcome his embarrassment enough to speak, he said softly,
I'm sorry, Padme. I'm sorry. I know I've been difficult to deal with. I feel like I'm in free fall. Free fall in the dark.
I don't know which way is up. I don't know where I'll be when I land or crash. He frowned against his fingers, squeezing his eyes more tightly shut to make sure no tears leaked out. I think it's going to be a crash. She sat on the wide-rolled arm of his chair and laid her slim arm along his shoulders.
What has happened, my love? You've always been so sure of yourself. What's changed?
Nothing, he said. Everything.
I don't know.
It's all so screwed up, I can't even tell you. The Council doesn't trust me. Palpatine doesn't trust the Council. They're plotting against each other, and both sides are pressuring me. And
surely that's only your imagination, Anakin.
The Jedi Council is the bedrock of the Republic. The bedrock of the Republic is democracy, Padme. Something the Council doesn't much like when votes don't go their way. All those who gain power are afraid to lose it. That's something you should remember.
He looked up at her.
You and your friends in the Senate.
She took this without a blink. But Obi-Wan is on the Council. He'd never participate in anything the least bit underhanded.
You think so? Because it's not for the record, Anakin. You must be able to understand why. He shook the memory away. It doesn't matter. Obi-Wan's on his way to Utapau.
What is this really about?
I don't know, he said helplessly. I don't know anything anymore. All I know is I'm not the Jedi I should be. I'm not the man I should be.
You're the man for me, she said, leaning toward him to kiss his cheek,
but he pulled away. You don't understand. Nobody understands. I'm one of the most powerful Jedi alive, but it's not enough. It'll never be enough. Not until... His voice trailed away, and his eyes went distant, and his memory burned with an alien birthing table, and blood, and screams.
Until what, my love?
Until I can save you, he murmured.
Save me?
From my nightmares. She smiled sadly.
Is that what's bothering you?
I won't lose you, Padme. I can't. He sat forward and twisted to take both of her hands, small and soft and deceptively strong and beyond precious, between his own. I am still learning, Padme. I have found a key to truths deeper than the Jedi could ever teach me. I will become so powerful that I will keep you safe. Forever. I will.
You don't need more power, Anakin. She gently extricated one of her hands and used it to draw him close.
I believe you can save me from anything, just as you are.
She pulled him to her and their lips met, and Anakin gave himself to the kiss. And while it lasted, he believed it too.
A shroud of twilight lowered upon Galactic City. Anakin stood at what a clone trooper would have called parade rest, a wide, balanced stance, feet parallel, hands clasped behind his back. He stood one pace behind and to the left of the chair where Palpatine sat, behind his broad desk in the small private office attached to his large public one. On the other side of the desk stood the Senate delegation. The way they had looked at him when they had entered the office, the way their eyes still, even now, flicked to his, then away again, before he could fully meet their gaze, the way none of them, not even Padme, dared to ask why the Supreme Chancellor had a Jedi at his shoulder during what was supposed to be a private meeting, it seemed to him that they already guessed why he was here. They were simply afraid to bring it up. Now they couldn't be sure where the Jedi stood. The only thing that was clear was where Anakin stood, respectfully in attendance upon Supreme Chancellor Palpatine. Anakin studied the senators. Fang Zar, face creased with old laugh lines, dressed in robes so simple they might almost be homespun, unruly brush of hair gathered into a tight topknot, and an even more unruly brush of beard that sprayed uncontrolled around his jaw. He had a gentle, almost simplistic way of speaking that could easily lead one to forget that he was one of the sharpest political minds in the Senate. Also, he was such a close friend of Garmbel Iblis that the powerful Corellian senator might as well have been present in person. Anakin had watched him closely throughout the meeting. Fang Zar had something on his mind, that was certain, something he did not seem willing to say. Nia Lavar and Malay D, he could dismiss as threats. The two stood together, perhaps needing each other for moral support, and neither had said anything at all. And then, of course, there was Padme, glowing in her senatorial regalia, the painted perfection of her face luminous as all four of Coruscant's moons together, not a single hair out of place in her elaborate coif, speaking in her politician voice and wearing her politician look. Padme did the talking. Anakin had a sickening suspicion that this was all her idea. "We are not attempting to delegitimize your government," she was saying. "That's why we're here. If we were trying to organize an opposition, if we sought to impose our requests as demands, we would hardly bring them before you in this fashion. This petition has been signed by 2,000 senators, Chancellor. We ask only that you instruct your governors not to interfere with the legitimate business of the Senate, and that you open peace talks with the separatists. We seek only to end the war and bring peace and stability back to our homeworlds. Surely you can understand this."
"I understand a great many things," Palpatine said.
"This system of governors you have created is very troubling. It seems that you are imposing military controls even on loyalist systems."
"Your reservations are noted, Senator Amidala. I assure you that the Republic governors are intended only to make your systems safer by coordinating planetary defense forces and ensuring that neighboring systems mesh into cooperative units and bringing production facilities up to speed in service to the war effort. That's all. They will in no way compete with the duties and prerogatives with the power of the Senate."
Something in the odd emphasis he put on the word power made Anakin think Palpatine was speaking more for Anakin's benefit than for Padme's.
"All those who gain power are afraid to lose it.
May I take it then, Padme said, that there will be no further amendments to the Constitution?
My dear Senator, what has the Constitution to do with this? I thought we were discussing ending the war. Once the separatists have been defeated, then we can start talking about the Constitution again. Must I remind you that the extraordinary powers granted to my office by the Senate are only in force for the duration of the emergency? Once the war ends, they expire automatically.
And your governors? Will they expire too?
They are not my governors, my lady. They are the Republic's,
Palpatine replied imperturbably.
The fate of their positions will be in the hands of the Senate, where it belongs.
Padme did not seem reassured. And peace talks? Will you offer a ceasefire? Have you even tried a diplomatic resolution to the war?
You must trust me to do the right thing, he said. That is, after all, why I am here.
Fang Zhar roused himself.
But surely, I have said I will do what is right, Palpatine said,
a testy edge sharpening his voice. He rose, drawing himself up to his full height, then inclining his head with an air of finality.
And that should be enough for your committee.
His tone said, don't let the door crunch you on the way out. Padme's mouth compressed into a thin, grim line. On behalf of the delegation of the 2000, she said with tight-drawn formality, I thank you, Chancellor.
And I thank you, Senator Amidala, and your friends.
Palpatine lifted the document reader containing the petition,
for bringing this to my attention.
The senators turned reluctantly and began to file out. Padme paused just for a second to meet Anakin's eyes with a gaze as clear as a slap on the mouth. He stayed expressionless. Because, in the end, no matter how much he wanted to, no matter how much it hurt, he couldn't quite make himself believe he was on her side.
Chapter 15. Death on Utapau.
When constructing an effective Jedi trap, as opposed to the sort that results in nothing more than an embarrassingly brief entry in the temple archives, there are several design features that one should include for best results. The first is an irresistible bait. The commanding general of an outlaw nation, personally responsible for billions of deaths across the galaxy, is ideal. The second is a remote, nearly inaccessible location, one that is easily taken and easily fortified, with a sharply restricted field of action. It should also, ideally, belong to someone else, preferably an enemy. The locations used for Jedi traps never survive the operation unscathed, and many don't survive it at all. An excellent choice would be an impoverished desert planet in the Outer Rim, with unwarlike natives whose few cities are built in a cluster of sinkholes on a vast arid plateau. A city in a sinkhole is virtually a giant kill jar. Once a Jedi flies in, all one need do is seal the lid. Third, since it is always a good idea to remain well out of reach when plotting against the Jedi's life, on the far side of the galaxy is considered best. One should have a reliable proxy to do the actual murder. The exemplar of a reliable proxy would be, for example, the most prolific living Jedi killer, backed up by a squad of advanced combat droids designed, built, and armed specifically to fight Jedi. Making one's proxy double as the bait is an impressively elegant stroke, if it can be managed, since it ensures that the Jedi victim will voluntarily place himself in contact with the Jedi killer, and will continue to do so even after he realizes the extent of the trap, out of a combination of devotion to duty and a not entirely unjustified arrogance. The fourth element of an effective Jedi trap is a massively overwhelming force
of combat troops who are willing to burn the whole planet, including themselves if necessary, to ensure that the Jedi in question does not escape. A textbook example of the ideal Jedi trap is the one that waited on Utapau for Obi-Wan Kenobi. As Obi-Wan sent his starfighter spiraling in toward a landing deck that protruded from the sheer sandstone wall of the biggest of Utapau's sinkhole cities, he reviewed what he knew of the planet and its inhabitants. There wasn't much. He knew that despite its outward appearance, Utapau was not a true desert planet. There was water aplenty in an underground ocean that circled its globe. The erosive action of this buried ocean had undermined vast areas of its surface, and frequent groundquakes collapsed them into sinkholes large enough to land a Victory-class Star Destroyer, where civilization could thrive below reach of the relentless scouring hyperwinds on the surface. He knew that the planet had little in the way of high technology, and that their energy economy was based on wind power. The planet's limited interstellar trade had begun only a few decades before, when off-world water mining companies had discovered that the waters of the world ocean were rich in dissolved trace elements. He knew that the inhabitants were near human, divided into two distinct species: the tall, lordly, slow-moving Utapauans, nicknamed Ancients for their astonishing longevity, and the stubby Utai, called Shorts, both for their stature and for their brief, busy lives. And he knew that Grievous was here. How he knew, he could not say. So far as he could tell, his conviction had nothing to do with the Force. But within seconds of the Vigilance's real space reversion, he was sure this was it. One way or another, this was the place his hunt for General Grievous would come to a close. He felt it in his bones. Utapau was a planet for endings. He was going in alone. Commander Cody and three battalions of troopers waited in rapid deployment vehicles, Ladeyes and Jadthu class landers, just over the horizon. Obi-Wan's plan was to pinpoint Grievous's location, then keep the bio-droid general busy until the clones could attack. He would be a one-man diversionary force, holding the attention of what was sure to be thousands or tens of thousands of combat droids directed inward toward him and Grievous to cover the approach of the clones. Two battalions would strike full force, with the third in reserve, both to provide reinforcements and to cover possible escape routes. "I can keep them distracted for quite some time," Obi-Wan had told Cody on the flight deck of Vigilance. "Just don't take too long." "Come on, boss," Cody had said, smiling out of Jango Fett's face. "Have I ever let you down?" "Well," Obi-Wan had said with a slim answering smile, "Kato Nymoidia, for starters." "That was Anakin's fault. He was the one who was late." "Oh? And who will you blame it on this time?" Obi-Wan had chuckled as he climbed into his starfighter's cockpit and strapped himself in. "Very well, then. I'll try not to destroy all the droids before you get there." "I'm counting on you, boss. Don't let me down."
"Have I ever?"
"Well," Cody had said with a broad grin, "there was Kato Nymoidia." Obi-Wan's fighter bucked through coils of turbulence. The rim of the sinkhole caught enough of the hyperwinds above that the first few levels of city resided in a semi-permanent hurricane. Whirling blades of wind-powered turbines stuck out from the sinkhole's sides on generator pods so scoured by the fierce winds that they might themselves have been molded of liquid sandstone. He fought the fighter's controls to bring it down level after level until the wind had become a mere gale. Even after reaching the landing deck in the depths of the sinkhole, R4-G9 had to extend the starfighter's docking claws to keep it from being blown, skidding right off the deck. A ribbed, semi-transparent canopy swung out to enfold the landing deck. Once it had settled into place around him, the howl of winds dropped to silence, and Obi-Wan popped the cockpit. A pack of Utai was already scampering toward the starfighter, which stood alone on the deck. They carried a variety of tools and dragged equipment behind them, and Obi-Wan assumed they were some sort of ground crew. Behind them glided the stately form of Inutapawin in a heavy deck-length robe of deep scarlet that had a lapel collar so tall it concealed his vestigial ear discs. The Utapawan's glabrous scalp glistened with a sheen of moisture, and he walked with a staff that reminded Obi-Wan vaguely of Yoda's beloved Gimmer stick.
That was quick, Obi-Wan thought, almost like they've been expecting me.
Greetings, young Jedi, the Utapawan said gravely in accented basic. I am Teon Maiden, Master of Port Administration for this place of peace. What business could bring a Jedi to our remote sanctuary?
Obi-Wan sensed no malice in this being, and the Utapawan radiated a palpable aura of fear. Obi-Wan decided to tell the truth. My business is the war, he said.
There is no war here, unless you have brought it with you.
Maedon replied, a mask of serenity concealing what the Force told Obi-Wan was anxiety verging on panic.
Very well, then, Obi-Wan said, playing along. Please permit me to refuel here and to use your city as a base to search the surrounding systems.
For what do you search?
Even in the Outer Rim, you must have heard of General Grievous. It is he I seek, and his army of droids.
Teon Maiden took another step closer and leaned down to bring his face near Obi-Wan's ear.
He is here,
Maiden whispered urgently.
We are hostages. We are being watched.
Obi-Wan nodded matter-of-factly. Thank you, Master Maiden, he said in a thoroughly ordinary voice. I am grateful for your hospitality and will depart as soon as your crew refuels my starfighter.
Listen to me, young Jedi.
Maiden's whisper became even more intense.
You must depart in truth. I was ordered to reveal their presence. This is a trap.
Of course it is, Obi-Wan said equably.
The 10th level. Thousands of war droids. Tens of thousands.
Have your people seek shelter.
Obi-Wan turned casually and scanned upward, counting levels. On the 10th, his eye found a spiny spheroid of metal, a dreadnought-sized structure that clearly had not been there for long. Its gleaming surface had not yet been scoured to matte by the sand in the constant winds. He nodded absently and spoke softly, as though to himself.
G9, take my starfighter back to the Vigilance. Instruct Commander Cody to inform Jedi Command on Coruscant that I have made contact with General Grievous. I am engaging now. Cody is to attack in full force as planned.
The astromech beeped acknowledgement from its forward socket, and Obi-Wan turned once more to Teon Maiden.
Tell them I promised to file a report with Republic Intelligence. Tell them I really only wanted fuel enough to leave immediately.
But what will you do?
If you have warriors, Obi-Wan said gravely, now is the time.
In the holocom center of Jedi Command, within the heart of the temple on Coruscant, Anakin watched a life-sized holoscan of Clone Commander Cody report that Obi-Wan had made contact with General Grievous.
We are beginning our supporting attack as ordered. And, if I may say so, sirs, from my experience working with General Kenobi, I have a suspicion that Grievous does not have long to live.
If I were there with him, Anakin thought, it'd be more than a suspicion. Obi-Wan, be careful.
Thank you, Commander.
Mace Windu's face did not betray the slightest hint of the mingled dread and anticipation Anakin was sure he must be feeling. While Anakin himself felt ready to burst, Windu looked calm as a stone.
Keep us apprised of your progress. May the Force be with you, and with Master Kenobi.
I'm sure it will be, sir. Cody out.
The holoscan flickered to nothingness. Mace Windu turned brief but seemingly significant glances upon the other two masters in attendance, both holoscans themselves. Ki-Adi Mundi, from the Fortified Command Center on Mygeeto, and from a guerrilla outpost on Kashyyyk, Yoda. Then he turned to Anakin.
Take this report to the Chancellor.
Of course I will, Master.
and take careful note of his reaction. We need a full account.
Master?
What he says, Anakin, who he calls, what he does, everything, even his facial expressions. It's very important.
I don't understand.
You don't have to. Just do it.
Master.
Anakin, do I have to remind you that you are still a Jedi? You are still subject to the orders of this council.
Yes, Master Windu. Yes, I am, he said, and left.
Once Skywalker was gone, Mace Windu found himself in a chair, staring at the doorway through which the young Jedi Knight had left. Now we shall see, he murmured. At last, the waters will begin to clear. Though he shared the command center with the holoscans of two other Jedi Masters, Mace wasn't talking to them. He spoke to the grim, clouded future inside his head.
Have you considered,
Ki-Adi-Mundi said carefully from far away Maegito,
that if Palpatine refuses to surrender power, removing him is only a first step?
Mace looked at the blue ghost of the Serene Master. I am not a politician. Removing a tyrant is enough for me.
But it will not be enough for the Republic,
Ki-Adi-Mundi countered sadly.
Palpatine's dictatorship has been legitimized and can be legalized, even enshrined in a revised constitution by the supermajority he controls in the Senate.
The grim future inside Mace's head turned even darker. The Saurian was right.
Filled with corruption, the Senate is,
Yoda agreed from Kashyyyk.
Controlled they must be. Until replaced, the corrupted senators can be with senators honest and,
do you hear us? Mace lowered his head into his hands. How have we come to this? Arresting a chancellor. Taking over the Senate. It's as though Dooku was right. To save the Republic, we'll have to destroy it. Yoda lifted his head, and his eyes slitted as though he struggled with some inner pain.
Hold on to hope, we must. Our true enemy, Palpatine, is not, nor the Senate. The true enemy is instead the Sith Lord Sidious, who controls them both. Once destroyed, Sidious is. All these other concerns, less dire they will instantly become.
Yes. Mace Windu rose and moved to the window, hands folded behind his back. Yes, that is true. Indigo gloom gathered among the towers outside. And we have put the Chosen One in play against the last Lord of the Sith, he said. In that, we must place our faith and our hopes for the future of the Republic. The landing deck canopy parted, and the blue and white Jedi starfighter blasted upward into the gale. From deep shadows at the rear of the deck, Obi-Wan watched it go. I suppose I am committed now, he murmured. Through electro-binoculars, produced from his equipment belt, he examined that suspiciously shiny spheroid high above on the 10th level. The spray of spines had to be droid control antennas. That's where Grievous would be, at the nerve center of his army. Then that's where I should be too. He looked around, frowning. Never an air taxi when you need one. The reclosing of the deck canopy quieted the howl of the wind outside. And now from deeper within the city, Obi-Wan could hear a ragged choir of hoarsely bellowing cries that had the resonance of large animals. They reminded him of something. Subatars, that was it. They sounded vaguely like the calls of the Subatars he and Anakin had ridden on one of their last missions before the war. Back when the biggest worry Obi-Wan had had was how to keep his promise to Qui-Gon. But he had no time for nostalgia. He could practically hear Qui-Gon reminding him to focus on the now and give himself over to the living force. So he did. Mere moments of following the cries through the shadows of deserted hallways carved into the sandstone brought Obi-Wan in sight of an immense circular arena-like area where a ring of balcony was joined to a flat lower level by spokes of broad corrugated ramps.
The ceiling above was hung with yellowish lamp rods that cast a light the same color as the sunbeams striking through an arc of wide oval archways, open to the interior of the sinkhole outside. The winds that whistled through those wide archways also went a long way toward cutting the eye-watering reptile den stench down from overpowering to merely nauseating. Squatting, lying, and milling aimlessly about the lower level were a dozen or so large lizard-like beasts that looked like the product of some mad geneticist's cross of Tatooine crate dragons with Harun Kal Ankoxen. 4 meters tall at the shoulder, long crooked legs that ended in 5 clawed feet, clearly designed for scaling rocky cliffs. 10 meters of powerful tail, ridged with spines and tipped with a horn-bladed mace. A flexible neck, leading up to an armor-plated head that sported an impressive cowl of spines of its own. They looked fearsome enough that Obi-Wan might have thought them some sort of dangerous wild predators or vicious watch beasts, were it not for the docile way they tolerated the team of Utai wranglers who walked among them, hosing them down, scraping muck from their scales, and letting them take bundles of greens from their hands. Not far from where Obi-Wan stood, several large racks were hung with an array of high-backed saddles in various styles and degrees of ornamentation, very much indeed like those the Alwari of Ancion had strapped to their subatars. Now he really missed Anakin. Anakin disliked living mounts almost as much as Obi-Wan hated to fly. Obi-Wan had long suspected that it was Anakin's gift with machines that worked against him with subatar or dewback or bantha. He could never get entirely comfortable riding anything with a mind of its own. He could vividly imagine Anakin's complaints as he climbed into one of these saddles. It seemed an awfully long time since Obi-Wan had had an opportunity to tease Anakin a bit. With a sigh, he brought himself back to business. Moving out of the shadows, he walked down one of the corrugated ramps and made a slight, almost imperceptible hand gesture in the direction of the nearest of the Utai Dragon Mount Wranglers. I need transportation. The short's bulging eyes went distant and a bit glassy, and he responded with a string of burbling glottal hoots that had a decidedly affirmative tone. Obi-Wan made another gesture. Get me a saddle. With another string of affirmative burbles, the short waddled off. While he waited for his saddle, Obi-Wan examined the dragon mounts. He passed up the largest and the one most heavily muscled. He skipped over the leanest, built for speed beast, and didn't even approach the one with the fiercest gleam in its eye. He didn't actually pay attention to outward signs of strength or health or personality. He was using his hands and eyes and ears purely as focusing channels for the Force. He didn't know what he was looking for, but he trusted that he would recognize it when he found it. Qui-Gon, he reflected with an inward smile, would approve. Finally, he came to a dragon mount with a clear, steady gleam in its round yellow eyes and small, close-set scales that felt warm and dry. It neither shied back from his hand nor bent submissively to his touch, but only returned his searching gaze with calm, thoughtful intelligence. Through the Force, he felt in the beast an unshakable commitment to obedience and care for its rider, an almost Jedi-like devotion to service as the ultimate duty. This was why Obi-Wan would always prefer a living mount. A speeder is incapable of caring if it crashes. This one, he said. I'll take this one. The short had returned with a plain, sturdily functional saddle. As he and the other wranglers undertook the complicated task of tacking up the dragon mount, he nodded at the beast and said, Boga. Ah, Obi-Wan said. Thank you. He took a sheaf of greens from a nearby bin and offered them to the dragon mount. The great beast bent its head. Its wickedly hooked beak delicately withdrew the greens from Obi-Wan's hand, and it chewed them with fastidious thoroughness. Good girl, Boga. Obi-Wan frowned at the short. She is a she, isn't she? The wrangler frowned back.
Warul Nogaglo, he said, shrugging.
which Obi-Wan took to mean, I have no idea what you're saying to me.
Very well, then, Obi-Wan said with an answering shrug. She you will have to be, then, Boga, unless you care to tell me otherwise. Boga made no objection. He swung himself up into the saddle, and the dragon mount rose, arching her powerful back in a feline stretch that lifted Obi-Wan more than 4 meters off the floor. Obi-Wan looked down at the Utai wranglers. I cannot pay you. As compensation, I can only offer the freedom of your planet. I hope that will suffice. Without waiting for a reply that he would not have understood anyway, Obi-Wan touched Boga on the neck. Boga reared straight up and raked the air with her hooked foreclaws as though she was shredding an imaginary hailfire droid, then gathered herself and leapt to the ring balcony in a single bound. Obi-Wan didn't need to use the long hook-tipped goad strapped in a holster alongside the saddle, nor did he do more than lightly hold the reins in one hand. Boga seemed to understand exactly where he wanted to go. The dragon mount slipped sinuously through one of the wide oval apertures into the open air of the sinkhole, then turned and seized the sandstone with those hooked claws to carry Obi-Wan straight up the sheer wall. Level after level they climbed. The city looked and felt deserted. Nothing moved, save the shadows of clouds crossing the sinkhole's mouth, far, far above. Even the wind-powered turbines had been locked down. The first sign of life, he saw, came on the 10th level itself. A handful of other dragon mounts lay basking in the midday sun, not far from the durasteel barnacle of the droid control center. Obi-Wan rode Boga right up to the control center's open archway, then jumped down from the saddle. The archway led into a towering vaulted hall, its durasteel decking bare of furnishing. Deep within the shadows that gathered in the hall stood a cluster of 5 figures. Their faces were the color of bleached bone or ivory armor plast. They looked like they might, just possibly, be waiting for him. Obi-Wan nodded to himself. You'd best find your way home, girl, he said, patting Boga's scaled neck. One way or another, I doubt I'll have further need of your assistance. Boga gave a soft, almost regretful honk of acknowledgement, then bent a sharper curve into her long, flexible neck to place her beak gently against Obi-Wan's chest. It's all right, Boga. I thank you for your help, but to stay here will be dangerous. This area is about to become a free-fire zone. Please, go home. The dragon mount honked again and moved back, and Obi-Wan stepped from the sun into the shadow. A wave front of cool passed over him with the shade's embrace. He walked without haste, without urgency. The Force layered connections upon connections and brought them all to life within him. The chilled deck plates beneath his boots, and the stone beneath those, and far below that, the smooth, lightless currents of the world ocean. He became the turbulent swirl of wind whistling through the towering vaulted hall. He became the sunlight outside and the shadow within. His human heart in its cage of bone echoed the beat of an alien one in a casket of armor plast, and his mind whirred with the electronic signal cascades that passed for thought in Jedi killer droids. And when the Force layered into his consciousness, the awareness